To RPH provides this edition of the Illawarra Mercury for Thursday, the 2nd of May, for listening on demand. We remind you that the program is copyright and, in accordance with our agreement with the publisher, is available for a period of 24 hours only from the time of original broadcast completion. You're reminded, as this is a recording, all included time calls should be disregarded.
The Illawarra Mercury, presented by your radio reading service, 2RPH.
And a very good morning to you. This is 2RPH, bringing you news, views and comment from the pages of today's Illawarra Mercury for Thursday, the 2nd of May. My name is Keith McCarran, and back off an extended holiday is Angela Rontidis. Good morning, Angela.
Happy to be here, Keith.
And it's wonderful to have you back in our midst. In today's program, we will look at what's making news on the front page. There is just the one story today on the front page of the Mercury. We'll follow that with local news stories, then some business reports and some sports articles. At 11 o'clock, we'll read today's death notices, and there are four today. We'll follow that with the editorial. Now, normally, they have some feature articles or opinion pieces. Similar to yesterday, and Mary Jane said they had then, they don't have any opinion pieces today either. So I've got a couple of world news items to fill that slot. And of course, we'll finish the program with letters to the editor and from the Lord Mayor's desk. But as always, let's start with the weather. And the weather situation for Thursday, the 2nd of May. There's a strong, slow-moving, high-pressure system south of the Bight, which extends a ridge to the southeast New South Wales. A trough will begin to form in the state's west from today and move eastwards later in the week, bringing rain to the northern and central inland. Then, increasing rain over the coast over the weekend. And so the forecast for the rest of Thursday, partly cloudy, with a high chance of showers along the coastal fringe, a medium chance elsewhere. Winds southerly, 15 to 25 kilometres an hour, becoming light in the evening. The daytime maximum temperature today is expected to be 19 degrees. 14 overnight and 18 degrees tomorrow. So the forecast for Friday, cloudy with a high chance of showers, winds south to southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres an hour, tending south to southeasterly in the middle of the day, and then becoming light in the late afternoon. Overnight temperatures, as I said, 14 and a maximum tomorrow expected of 18 degrees. For Saturday, cloudy with a very high chance of showers, and Sunday, cloudy also with a very high chance of showers. Now looking around the region, in Sydney today, 22 degrees and, again, showers. Nowra, 18 and showers. Batemans Bay, 18 and a shower or two. Naruma, 18 and a shower or two. Looking inland, Cooma, 15 degrees and cloudy today. Goulburn, also 15, but partly cloudy. And in Barrel, 14 degrees and a shower or two. Canberra today, 17 degrees and partly cloudy, and tomorrow, 17 degrees also, with an expected minimum overnight of 2 degrees. Coming up for the weekend, looking at the Illawarra Coastal Waters Report for the boaters and the fishers. And this, of course, is from Port Hacking to Ulla Dulla. The winds southerly, 15 to 20 knots. Seas, 1 to 1.5 metres. The swell is southerly, 1.5 to 2.5 metres. And the weather out to sea, partly cloudy with an 80% chance of showers. The tides today at Port Kembla, the first high was at 15 minutes past 2 this morning at 1.6 metres. So The next high today will be at 20 to 4 at 1.3 metres. And that's 20 to 4 this afternoon, of course. The first low, 26 minutes past 9 this morning at 0.4 of a metre. And the next low will be at 9 o'clock tonight at 0.7 of a metre. And that's your weather for the weekend.
On 2RPH, you're listening to news from Wollongong and the Illawarra from the pages of the Mercury.
And there is just the one story on the front page of today's Illawarra Mercury. We're failing kids. In a shocking indictment of our child protection system, it's been revealed only one in four Illawarra children at risk of serious harm see a caseworker. The full story is on page 3, and Angela has the details.
Yes, only one in four at-risk kids in Illawarra see a caseworker, and this is by Natalie Croxon. Fewer than a quarter of children at risk of serious harm in the Illawarra are seen by a caseworker, as chronic understaffing continues to afflict the state's child protection system. Child protection caseworkers, based in Coniston, walked off the job on Wednesday, May Day, in protest over a sector they say is in crisis. Department of Communities and Justice data shows there were 8,098 children under 18 reported as being at risk of serious harm in the Illawarra, Shoalhaven and southern New South Wales in the 3 months ending December 2023. But only 2,006, or 23%, were seen by caseworkers. Elsewhere, it has it even worse. The proportion of children at risk seen is as low as 15% in the state's north. 7% of caseworker positions in the region are vacant. But the Public Service Association says this can be as high as 1 in 5 on any given day due to people off on workers' compensation or long-term sick leave. Almost half of all DCJ caseworkers in New South Wales leave the job within their first 2 years. Public Service Association, PSA, General Secretary Stuart Little said caseworkers were walking off the job because the child protection system was effectively in collapse. Mr. Little said children who came from intergenerational disadvantage faced the prospect of being neglected by this system and ending up in the criminal justice system. You can't have a system where we're seeing one child in four. It is a disgrace, he said. Mr. Little said child protection was a critical part of the response to the domestic violence crisis. He said the government needed to intervene to attract and retain caseworkers to the job. The PSA is asking the state government to recruit 500 new caseworkers, provide an immediate and substantial pay rise, and deprivatise foster care. Mr. Little said such a pay rise would, at a minimum, be in the vicinity of $10,000. We need to get the government to produce a roadmap out of this, Mr. Little said. They need to give us a timeline ending the privatisation of out-of-home care. We need that money that's been blown out reinvested into these workers. He said the wage cap imposed by the previous coalition government had driven vacancies across the public sector. Minister for Families and Communities, Kate Washington, said the Labor government had inherited a child protection system that was spiralling out of control, but was undertaking significant structural reform. A critical element of our reform will involve the attraction and retention of caseworkers, Ms. Washington said. In the past year, I've met with hundreds of hard-working caseworkers and heard firsthand their frustration, exhaustion, and fears for those they seek to support. This can't be fixed overnight, but we took the immediate step last year of abolishing the pay cap and provided child protection caseworkers with their largest pay increase in over a decade. But there is still much more work to do, and that was only one in four at-risk kids in Illawarra see a caseworker, written by Natalie Croxon and appearing on page 3.
On 2RPH, you're listening to news from Wollongong and the Illawarra from the pages of the Mercury.
And with the time at 10 minutes past 10, it's time to turn inside the paper for local news. In this first story, on page 2, woman had to sleep in car at the beach after an assault. And the article is by court reporter Grace Crivellaro. An Illawarra woman was too afraid to phone police after a former partner repeatedly struck her in the face in her own home, ultimately fled and slept car. Stephen Newton, a 55-year-old plumber from Theresa Park, faced Wollongong local court on Monday and pleaded guilty to assault occasioning actual bodily harm and intimidation. Tendered court documents state an intoxicated Newton phoned the woman at about 8:40 on December the 6th, 2023, and asked her to pick him up from Beaches Hotel in Thirroul. She arrived at the pub and tried to call out to Newton without drawing attention to herself, but one of his friends began verbally abusing her as he noticed her. Newton left the pub and got in the car with the woman, where he raised his voice and called her a psychopath, among several other insulting names. She pulled over and Newton told her to wake up to yourself before slapping her across the forehead. Once back at her home, the woman said Newton was no longer welcome there and that she would collect his belongings. However, he walked inside and laid on the lounge. She repeatedly asked him to leave, but Newton struck her in the face, causing the woman to fall. She felt her teeth move and her nose to bleed. Newton went into the woman's bedroom and got into her bed, continuing to ignore repeated requests to leave. A tug of war with blankets began, which resulted in the woman falling and hitting a bedside table. She continued to ask him to leave, making it clear she no longer wanted him in her life. Newton got out of the bed and pulled the woman to the floor before he grabbed her again and began hitting her back and ribs, causing bruising. She was also hit in the face and sustained a split lip. Newton went back to sleep while the woman was too afraid to phone police. She ultimately fled to a nearby beach and slept in her car until about 8 a.m. The victim returned home, where Newton was still sleeping, and demanded that he leave. He asked her to drop him to his vehicle and walked off from her home, verbally abusing her after she refused. That night, police obtained a statement from the woman and took photographs of her injuries. Magistrate Mark Douglas said the matter was serious as it involved prolonged assaults, before adjourning it to May the 10th for sentence. An apprehended violence order was fixed for 2 years to protect the victim. And that first local news story on page 2, woman had to sleep in car at beach after assault. And it was by court reporter Grace Crivellaro.
And now on page 4, written by Nadine Morton, unit resident rushes to protect lives. A Wollongong resident has helped protect the lives of others in his unit block after a shopping trolley loaded with items was set on fire in the foyer. The blaze ignited inside the three-storey public housing block on Cliff Road, with thick black smoke billowing up through the stairwell at 8:39 a.m. on Wednesday. We got a call from a tenant. Smoke had gone up through the stairwell and she was in a panic, Fire and Rescue New South Wales Wollongong Station Officer Greg Faulkner said. One of the tenants on the second floor pushed the trolley outside. When firefighters arrived at the unit complex, the trolley was on the lawn with its contents still burning. The fire was extinguished and police officers sent to the scene to investigate. The blaze caused minor damage to an electrical subboard at the unit block. This is not the first suspicious fire to erupt at the social housing block after a car was set on fire with flames quickly spreading to a second vehicle and a boat in August 2023. And that was Unit Resident Rushes to Protect Lives, written by Nadine Morton and appearing on page 4.
Turning to page 3 now for this environment story. It's written by Ben Langford under the headline, Companies Caught Win Over Slag Dump. A company has had a win in against the cancellation of its licence to dump smelter slag at Karungala, Swan Primby. The Environment Protection Authority, or EPA, had revoked Mimosa Rehabilitations Proprietary Limited's licence to dump slag from the old Port Kembla copper smelter at the wetlands site off Windang Road. Mimosa challenged this in the Land and Environment Court, arguing the licence should not be revoked until its plans for the 12.8-hectare site had been made clear. Its plans for the site, modifying its consent to allow another 15 years to dump slag and extract sand, had been refused by Wollongong City Council in February this year. The council's planners refused the proposal on several grounds, including that it presented unacceptable potential environmental and social risks, was not in the public interest, hadn't been shown to be a suitable site, and that Mimosa hadn't provided adequate information on the plans. Nor was it substantially the same as the original consent, so shouldn't be dealt with by way of a modification. But Mimosa still had the possibility to appeal against this decision and argued that it had not finished deciding whether it wanted to appeal, so the licence should not be revoked. At a conciliation meeting organised by the court between Mimosa and the EPA, they agreed to not revoke the licence yet and simply suspend it instead until Mimosa has decided what to do. The licence permits the extraction of about 1.5 million tonnes of sand from the site and emplacement there of about 3 million tonnes of metallurgical slag produced from the Port Kembla smelter. In her decision, Acting Land and Environment Court Commissioner Nicola Target said she was satisfied the EPA's revocation notice should itself be revoked on three grounds. The applicant was still considering its position in relation to the refusal of the modification application. The outcome of this or an extension of time would affect the scope and operation of the licence, and the parties had agreed that the licence would be suspended instead of revoked until the council process was finished. Mimosa's plans, what could be seen of them, caused an outcry among residents of Primby, who have loudly opposed any move to continue dumping material there. The Port Kembla copper smelter has long been closed, decommissioned and demolished, so Mimosa won't be receiving any more slag for emplacement there. But residents have voiced concerns over the potential for other types of waste to be received. And that story on page 3, Companies Caught Win Over Slag Dump, was written by Ben Langford.
And Airport Expansion Plans Now in Doubt, written by Connor Pierce with Anne McGuinness, appearing on page 4. As the leading contender to operate budget flights from Shell Harbour Airport is grounded, questions are being asked whether plans to upgrade the airport to accommodate larger planes should be considered. On Tuesday, April 30, low-cost regional carrier Bonza entered voluntary administration. The company's finances had been the focus of speculation since it was reported that advisory firm Cordamantha had been brought in by Bonza's backers. A statement from Bonza's CEO Tim Jordan confirmed that the startup's fleet of purple planes were remaining on the tarmac as the company sorted its affairs. Bonza was suggested as one of the leading contenders to operate low-cost services out of Shell Harbour Airport if a mooted $20 million upgrade of the airport went ahead. Council is now considering community feedback on the proposal, which also suggested a limited upgrade to the terminal or to keep the airport as it is. The Mercury understands that while no airline had committed to operating additional passenger services to Shell Harbour, the council was in advanced talks with Bonza, whose business model had been flying between destinations that were not otherwise served by a national carrier. Councillor Rob Petreski, who cautioned against a build-and-they-will-come mentality in a council meeting in February, said the council should be wary of committing additional funds to the airport. Our residents, quite rightfully, demand prudent decision-making when we're spending their money, he said. Kiama MP Gareth Ward said Shell Harbour residents shouldn't give up on the dream of flying to destinations around Australia without having to deal with Sydney traffic just yet. I would love to see a budget carrier in our region which makes air travel more affordable for our local people, he said. When you look at the catchment for Shell Harbour Airport, there is a huge population to draw on. The Shell Harbour Airport Master Plan estimates the airport had a catchment of nearly 500,000 people, stretching from Helensburgh to Ulladulla and Mossvale, making it the 9th largest population centre in Australia. RDA Illawarra CEO Selena Stevens said, based on these figures, there would be a market for a budget carrier to operate out of Shell Harbour. Absolutely, there are enough people to commercially support a budget carrier or carriers into the region. The Illawarra Shoalhaven Regional Plan says the government recognises the potential of the airport to support regional economic development, tourism and employment, and calls upon councils to continue to manage and protect Shell Harbour Airport's land and airspace to support aviation operations, including regular public transport. Mr. Ward said the airport could also be an economic and defence hub, similar to HMAS Albatross south of Nowra. The defence partnership has generated hundreds of local jobs in the Shoalhaven, and the Shell Harbour Airport has the capacity to do something similar for aviation businesses in the Illawarra. But with another hopeful entrant to the Australian aviation industry once again hitting the wall, and the opening of the Western Sydney Airport in 2026, Shell Harbour MP Anna Watson said council should stick to other priorities. They should be looking at their priorities and go back to the drawing board, she said. The core business of council is not airports. It's roads, rubbish and rates. And that was Airport Expansion Plans Now in Doubt by Connor Pearce with Anna McGuinness, and appearing on page 4.
If you are looking for informed and lively comment on what's happening on the world scene, join Keith McCarron for readings from the New Statesman, leading progressive political and cultural magazine in the United Kingdom and around the world. Each week we hear what those in the know think about politics, the economy, literature and other topical issues. The New Statesman, every Thursday at 9 p.m.
And the time is 23 minutes past 10.
Live in Wollongong and the Illa on 93.3 FM, this is your radio reading service, 2RPH.
My name's Carol and I'm a survivor. Why did I decide to join a radiotherapy clinical trial through Trog Cancer Research? Because I want to be here for my family. Because I want better treatments for all of us. Because cancer saves lives. Please support Trog Cancer Research today. Visit trog.com.au/donate. Because together we can find the answer.
You're listening to local news stories from today's Illawarra Mercury. And this story on page 4, Gippsland gets offshore wind go-ahead. Next up, Illawarra. And the story is by Connor Pearce. After the first licences to pursue offshore wind projects in the Bass Strait off Gippsland were granted, orders are now on the waters of the Hunter and the Illawarra as the next stage of the offshore wind pipeline. On Wednesday, Energy and Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen announced the 6 developers that have been granted feasibility licences. Another 6 have been provisionally selected, but are subject to First Nations consultation. Hopeful Illawarra proponent Blue Float, which had put forward its Greater Gippsland proposal with Origin Energy, was not selected. The licences will enable successful developers to begin scoping sections of the ocean to produce detailed plans, including environmental studies and management plans. I've awarded feasibility licences to projects that would bring the most rewards for Gippsland, its workforce and for our energy security, Mr. Bowen said. The decision means that now attention will turn to the next most advanced regions, the Hunter and the Illawarra. Emily Scivetti, Chief Operations Officer of OceanX, which is partnered with Norwegian energy giant Equinor to develop its Illawarra offshore wind proposal, said the focus would now turn to the Illawarra. "We're very encouraged by this announcement because it means that the attention now turns to New South Wales," she said. While industry had hoped for Mr. Bowen to make the earlier call, or the call earlier in the year, Ms. Scivetti said that approvals were expected to accelerate now that Gippsland had been announced. Prior to the announcement, Port Kembla had been touted for its role in the Gippsland region, following uncertainty about the Port of Hastings, with Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek ruling out the expansion of the port due to impacts on a sensitive wetland. New South Wales Port CEO Marika Kalfas said Port Kembla was the site that was the best position to support offshore wind projects, including those interstate. Port Kembla, in our view, is the most progressive. I've just lost that. Give me 1 second. Port Kembla, in our view, is the most progressive in terms of its plans and ability to deliver the infrastructure needed to support those projects, not just on the New South Wales coast, but in Victoria and Gippsland. New South Wales Ports has repurposed plans to build a container terminal in Port Kembla's outer harbour to support offshore wind zones, as the container terminal is not expected to be needed until the 2050s. Ms. Scivetti said this approved development proposal meant Port Kembla was attractive to offshore wind developers. "It is likely that Port Kembla will be able to service the offshore wind industry, and we would expect a multi-port solution for the east coast of Australia. While a Victorian port will be necessary for the construction of Gippsland projects, we would hope to see Port Kembla play a key role in servicing not only New South Wales projects, but also meeting the developers' needs in Gippsland." And that story on page 4. Gippsland gets the offshore wind go-ahead. Next up is Illawarra. It was written by Connor Pierce.
And on page 5, the heading is Scully Hits Back Over Housing Reforms, and it's also by Connor Pierce. Wollongong MP and Planning Minister Paul Scully has hit back at suggestions the government's reform do not go far enough in addressing housing affordability in the Illawarra. This week, the government confirmed changes two zoning rules around 18 stations, including at Corrimal in the Illawarra. The changes would permit apartment buildings of up to 6 stories within 400 metres of the station, with a requirement that 2% of any development over 2,000 metres be set aside as affordable housing in perpetuity. Housing Trust CEO Michelle Adair said the changes would do nothing to increase the supply of affordable housing. 2% is manifestly inadequate. Mr. Scully said the changes to zoning around stations was only one part of the government's wider suite of reforms. "It works in with the other measures that we've got in place, and you've got to remember that starting at 2% is already greater than zero." Mr. Scully cited changes that would allow additional heights if apartments are affordable and relaxed pathways for social and affordable housing as other measures that would improve affordability. At the same time, property groups have said that 2% provision may impact the viability of redevelopment proposals and have said the affordable element should be time limited. While we absolutely support the need for more affordable housing, there is also some concern around the requirement for affordable housing to be held in perpetuity under the two-tier program, as it will place further pressure on already strained development feasibilities, Property Council Illawarra Regional Director Michelle Guido said. "For this to work, the government needs to rethink the approach to managing and monitoring affordable housing stock." The Urban Development Institute of Australia made a similar point, noting that 2%, particularly in smaller projects, would be less than a single unit, making the requirement impractical. We encourage the Premier and the Minister for Planning to closely monitor the uptake of the TOD program in the coming 12 months and commit to making improvements that will help improve development feasibility if it becomes clear it is not delivering as hoped. UDIA New South Wales Acting CEO Gavin Melvin said, "However, Mr. Scully said he was confident in the design of the reforms and that the 2% figure could instead go up. We're committed to increasing it," he said. "The bottom line is, when you've got complaints from some people that it doesn't go far enough and from others that it goes too far, we've probably got the balance right." Wollongong Lord Mayor Gordon Bradbury has called for the New South Wales Government to rule out increased densities around North Wollongong Station due to flooding concerns and to consider Coniston and the Unanderra instead. But Mr. Scully said all locations were on the table. And that was Scully Hits Back Over Housing Reforms, written by Connor Pearce and appearing on page 5.
Turning to page 7 now, where Grace Crivellaro, court reporter, writes, "Shoppers flee after food court brawl breaks out." A group of young men who cornered their victim in the toilet area of Wollongong Mall later threw chairs at him in the food court while shoppers ran for their safety. Junior and Jeremiah Peruto, both 21, and Ryan Tosh, 19, faced Wollongong Local Court on Tuesday and pleaded guilty to a midday affray on the 21st of March 2023, which was captured on CCTV. Tendered court documents state the footage showed Junior, Jeremiah, Tosh and two other men waiting for the victim outside the toilet area on Level 1 at Wollongong Central. Tosh shaped the man when he left the toilet before the rest of the group followed him to the food court area. Junior threw a large drink bottle at the victim, which caused a violent melee to break out. The victim ran backwards to avoid further assault. However, Junior picked up a steel and plastic chair and launched it at the man, hitting him in the upper body. Tosh and another man from the group punched the victim in the head and body while Jeremiah threw a chair at him, which narrowly missed. Several members of the public who were eating lunch fled from the food court, fearing for their safety. The victim continued to try and run from the area. However, the group chased after him. The victim threw a punch at Tosh in self-defence, while Junior ran towards the victim while holding a chair with both arms above his head. The group shaped up to the man for about a minute before security guards and shoppers separated them. Police were called and reviewed CCTV footage from the mall, immediately recognising Junior, Jeremiah and Tosh from past interactions. Court documents state the relationship between the victim and the group is known. The trio were arrested the next day and each pleaded guilty to a fray. They will be sentenced on the 11th of June. And that story on page 7, "Shoppers Flee After Food Court Brawl Breaks Out." It was by Grace Crivellaro.
And also by Grace Crivellaro on page 7, "Man Made Crude Calls to Friend's Mum." A Balambi tradie who repeatedly harassed his friend's mother with crude late-night phone calls attributed his behaviour to an addiction to pornography. The 20-year-old, who cannot be named, was sentenced at Wollongong Local Court on Tuesday after he pleaded guilty to using a carriage service to menace, harass or offend, stemming from 17 phone calls across a 12-month period. Tendered court documents state the victim, a woman in her 50s, first received a call from a private number just after 11 p.m. one evening in September 2022 and heard a young male's voice on the line. "Help me, I need you to help me come," the voice said. The victim thought it was strange, however believed it was her son, who may have been intoxicated and in need of help. The voice repeated the sentence while the victim asked where he was located. He replied, "I'm at Thurille Beach. I need you to come here and help me come." The victim left her home with her daughter and scoured Thurille Beach in search of her son. She spent 40 minutes on the phone to who she thought was her son, who continued to repeat the same line. until he said he wanted her to sit on his C-K. The woman grew suspicious and asked her daughter to call her brother. He answered the phone, confirmed he was at a gathering and had not called. Over the following year, she received multiple late-night calls from a private number and left most unanswered. Last September, she picked up the phone with an intention to record the voice, which again said, "I need help, I need to come." She received another 3 calls that night, however didn't answer due to feeling distressed. She phoned police the next morning, who arrived at her home and obtained her call history. Police identified a phone number through iAsk records and called it. With the man answering, he presented himself to the police station on February the 15th. The man's defence lawyer said his client truly appreciates that what he has done is wrong, and that he was engaging in psychological treatment for an addiction to pornography. Magistrate Gabriel Fleming imposed an 18-month conditional release order with a conviction and ordered the men to continue with psychological treatment. And that was man-made crude calls to Fran's mum, and written by Grace Crivellaro and appearing on page 7.
Tune in to hear readings from The New Yorker. Award-winning journalism, in-depth reporting, political and cultural commentary, poetry, humour and more from this long-standing and highly-acted publication. Join us, Chris McGregor and Sam Russell, on alternate Fridays at 6:30 p.m, repeated the following Thursday at 3:30 p.m, to hear selections from the latest edition of The New Yorker. On 2RPH, your radio reading service.
When driving, it's important for you to be buckled up at all times, but have you thought about the safety of your child? All children up to 7 years of age must be safely fastened in a capsule, child safety seat, or booster seat, depending on their age and size. Fines and demerit points apply to drivers who don't ensure all children are safely buckled in when travelling in a vehicle. Call 13 22 13 to find the location of your nearest fitting station. Authorised by the New South Wales Government, Sydney.
And the time is 23 minutes to 11. You're listening to local news from today's Illawarra Mercury.
You're listening to 2RPH, broadcasting in Wollongong and the Illawarra region on 93.3 FM.
I'm now turning to page 8 for a national news item. It's unattributed, but the headline reads, "Violence met with billion-dollar package." Women looking to escape violent relationships will be able to access $5,000 financial support through an almost $1 million package as part of National Cabinet measures tackling domestic abuse. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with state and territory leaders on ways to reduce gendered violence in Sydney on Wednesday. Under the reforms, the federal government will provide $925 million over 5 years to set up the Leaving Violence program, which will provide financial aid and support referrals to women looking to remove themselves from harm. The measures are to be funded in the May federal budget. Those eligible will be able to access $5,000 in support, with $1,500 paid in cash and $3,500 made up of goods and services to be indexed in coming years. National Cabinet also agreed to implement measures addressing misogyny online, specifically aimed at young people. As part of the move, laws will be introduced to ban the creation and distribution of deep fake pornography. A pilot program will be set up for age assurance technology to block access for children to online content such as pornography. A review of the Online Safety Act will also be carried out a year ahead of schedule. National Cabinet will hold a further meeting on domestic and family violence in the next financial quarter. Mr. Albanese said tangible action was needed. "This is indeed a national crisis, and it's a national challenge, and we're facing this with a spirit of national unity," he told reporters. We want to change this in a way in which we all have to take responsibility, because violence against women is not a women's problem to solve. It's a whole of society problem. Men, in particular, have to take responsibility. Leaders agreed to strengthen systems responses to domestic and family violence, with a focus on high-risk and serial offenders, as well as information sharing about perpetrators between jurisdictions. The Council of Police Ministers and Standing Council of Attorneys General will look at options to improve police responses to gendered violence as well. The SNAP National Cabinet meeting followed a recent surge in gendered homicide, with thousands marching across the country in protest. The Prime Minister said action to address misogynistic content online was needed to ensure laws could catch up to technology. We can't afford to set and forget. We need to continue to look at what are the challenges and how do we overcome them, he said. A new online ad campaign challenging misogynistic stereotypes perpetrated on the internet will be rolled out in mid-June until May of 2025. Mr. Albanese said while the measures agreed to at National Cabinet were a good step forward, there was still a long way to go. Can we be satisfied when a woman is losing her life on average every 4 days? Of course not, he said. And if this article brings up any issues for you, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or Respect, that is 1800 737 732. 1800 737 732. And that national news story on page 8, Violence Met with Billion-Dollar Package, was an unattributed story.
And another unattributed story on the same page, Warning Before Fatal Crash. Decorated Army pilot captain Daniel Lyon warned his colleagues someone would die one day in an incident with a helicopter. Months later, he was killed in a crash alongside Lieutenant Maxwell Nugent, Warrant Officer Class 2 Joseph Laycock, and Corporal Alexander Neggs, when their MRH-90 Taipan plunged into the sea. The chopper, given the call sign Bushman 83, had been flying in formation with three others for Lindemann Island in Queensland as part of Exercise Talisman Sabre in July 2023. A few months before the tragedy, Captain Lyon had attended a meeting with Defence to discuss an incident over Jervis Bay when an MRH-90 suffered an engine failure in March 2023, causing it to ditch into the sea. The crew had been praised for the handling of the emergency and no one was killed, but Captain Lyon did not feel like the issue had been rectified. He did not believe adequate measures had been put in place to prevent a similar incident happening again. Someone is going to die from this one day, he told the meeting. And that was Warning Before Fatal Crash, an unattributed story appearing on page 8.
Also on page 8, and the last national news story for today, hotel quarantine case has been canned. Criminal charges over Victoria's fatally flawed COVID-19 hotel scheme have been dropped, with the workplace watch criticising the decision by prosecutors. WorkSafe charged the Department of Health in September 2021 with 58 breaches of the Occupational Health and Safety Act after a 15-month investigation into the bungled scheme. But the case has been canned days out from the trial after the county court threw out evidence unearthed during a separate judicial inquiry. Health Minister Mary Ann Thomas confirmed the charges against the department had been dropped by the Office of Public Prosecutions. WorkSafe is deeply disappointed by the decision to discontinue criminal proceedings, a spokesperson said in a statement. As an independent regulator, WorkSafe strives to enforce the highest standards of health and safety for workers and the community it serves. The case fell apart after the 9th of April ruling by the county court to exclude evidence produced by the 2020 judicial inquiry, led by Jennifer Coate, into the hotel quarantine scheme. The ruling was that 10 witnesses provided statements to the Coate inquiry on the health department's behalf, and under legislation, the statements could not be used against the department. The prosecutor's office did not appeal the decision and said it substantially weakened their case. And that story on page 8. Hotel quarantine case has been canned. We'll be back with all of your business news right after this.
May you live in interesting times may not in fact be an ancient Chinese curse. But if you're looking for incisive, agenda-setting reporting on international affairs, culture, science and economics, why not join me, Bruce Michel, when I present selected readings from The Economist each Monday at 9 p.m, repeated on Thursdays at 2:30 p.m.
And the time is 10:45. You're listening to the Illawarra Mercury on 2RPH, broadcasting on 93.3 FM. And the business news page today is page 24. And here's Angela with the first item.
And the headline is, calls for job seeker boost quashed. Calls to boost job seeker and youth allowance payments have been hosed down by Treasurer Jim Chalmers, who says he will look at other ways to help struggling Australians as he prepares his third budget. A dozen top economists have joined a growing chorus of voices in the community sector, academia and elsewhere, urging the government to increase inadequate income support payments in the May 14 budget. Dr. Chalmers said the budget was on other ways to help people doing it especially tough. The government boosted the base rates of working age and student payments by $40 a fortnight last year, he told Channel 7's Sunrise show on Wednesday. Yet, the economists, in an open letter to the Prime Minister, said the $386 per week rate of JobSeeker welfare support was still too low and failing to increase it would inch disadvantage in the community. Rich Insight economist Richardson, Impact Economics and Policy Lead economist Angelidon, and Independent economist Saul Eslake were among the signatories. Last week, the Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee stood up in 2022 to provide independent advice to the government before every budget, recommended boosting job seeker payments to 90% of the age pension. Raising income support payments was the best way to provide cost of living relief to people who need it most, the economists said in their letter, and was more targeted than tax cuts. We estimate that lifting payments to 90% of the pension would cost $4.6 billion per annum, which is a core cost of the Stage 3 tax cuts, they wrote. Dr. Jackson, speaking at the National Press Club on Wednesday, said boosting JobSeeker and other income supports would help support women fleeing domestic violence and single parents. The government has announced nearly $1 billion in funding for women escaping violence or abusive situations, amid public outcry over a spike in the rate of women killed by an intimate partner. Dr. Jackson welcomed the announcement but urged the government to ease underlying poverty and boost income support payments, noting women who had experienced family violence were three times more likely to endure financial insecurity. With just 2 weeks to go before the federal budget, Dr. Chalmers has also been outlining upcoming changes to foreign investment laws. Rising geopolitical tensions, the race to net zero, fragmenting markets, shifting demographics and supply chain shocks were the new normal, Dr. Chalmers said during an address to the Lowy Institute. We are now in a new phase in the global economy, one just only becoming evident, he said. And that article was headed call for Job Seeker Boost quashed and appeared on the business page 24.
The second article on today's business page, licences go to nation's first offshore projects. Australia's first offshore wind projects will begin after being granted feasibility licences to unlock the energy, climate and economic benefits of the power source. Awarding licences for the nation-leading Gippsland zone off Victoria's coast, Energy Minister Chris Bowen said offshore wind would be energy-rich and jobs-rich for six development zones around Australia. That's why major Australian energy users, from Alcoa in Portland to BlueScope in the Illawarra to Tomago Hunter, say that offshore wind is vital to their energy future, he said. The proposed Gippsland projects alone could generate more than 15,000 jobs during construction and another 7,500 ongoing jobs, he said. Eyeing at least 2 gigawatts of offshore wind energy by 2032, 4 gigawatts by 2035 and 9 gigawatts by 2040, Victorian Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio said the zone would be key to the state's renewable energy transition. Those given the green light include Australia's most advanced project, Southerly 10's Star of the Sea, or Star of the South, and the developers Kutwut Bratwurrung, as well as High Sea Wind, Gippsland Skies, Blue Mackerel North, and Ørsted's Gippsland 01. Southerly 10 Chief Executive Charles Rattray said the group's two projects would power more than 2.4 million homes and inject $14 billion into the economy. That was our second business story of today. Licences go to nation's first offshore wind projects.
And a third article on the business page, US wage data drives share market plunge. The Australian share market has plunged across the board after stronger than expected US wage data raised fears of more hawkish commentary from the US Federal Reserve. The benchmark S&P ASX 200 index on Wednesday finished down 94.2 points, or 1.23%, to 7,569.9, while the broader All Ordinaries dropped 100.1 points, or 1.26%, to 7,831.9. Overnight, a report showed US employment costs rose 1.2% last quarter, a higher-than-expected wage gain, renews concern about inflation in the world's largest economy. This isn't going to calm any nerves at the Fed, BMO Capital Markets chief economist Scott Anderson told CNN. The Federal Reserve could announce it is pushing back when it will trim borrowing costs when its rate-setting board finishes its latest two-day meeting early Thursday, AEST. Every ASX sector fell at least 0.5% on Wednesday. Energy was the biggest mover, dropping 2% as Brent crude fell below $86 a barrel for the first time since late March. Woodside Energy retreated 2.6%. Centus subtracted 2.1% and Ampol finished down 3.5%. Overall, just 16 of the 200 companies in the ASX 200 finished in the green, with another 4 closing flat. Gold miners were among the biggest losers, with the precious metal sliding to a one-month low of US$2,280 as the expectations for rate cuts eased. Three of the 4 big retail banks were lower, with CBA down 0.5% to $113.92, Westpac retreating 0.7% to $25.79, and ANZ dipping 0.3% to $28.08. NAB was the outlier, basically flat at $33.79. The Aussie dollar was at a one-week low against the greenback, buying 64.80 US cents from 64.23 US cents at Tuesday's ASX close. And that was US wage data drives share market plunge.
And the fourth and final story from the business page today, home values defy gravity for the 15th successive month. Australia has clocked its 15th month in a row of house price growth despite wobbly economic conditions, with prices gaining a further 0.6% in April. Dwelling values were growing at the same pace in April as in both February and March, according to CoreLogic's Home Value Index. Research director at the real estate data firm, Tim Lawless, said home values were still rising despite higher interest rates, low sentiment, worsening affordability, and ongoing cost of living pressures. Housing values are now up 11.1%, or around $78,000, since the trough in January last year. However, the prospect of higher for longer interest rates, stubborn price pressures, worsening housing affordability, and slowing economic activity could weigh on price growth. And that was our final business story. Home values defy gravity for the 15th successive month. And now a quick look at Market Watch. Your Aussie dollar was this morning buying 66.8 US cents, 53.5 Great British pence, and $1.12 New Zealand. And in commodities, gold is currently selling for $2,285 US dollars a fine ounce, and oil is $87.87 US cents a barrel. We'll be back with your sports news right after this.
Fancy little Dickens, a snippet of Hemingway, a scene from Jane Austen, a letter by Virginia Woolf. Why not join me, David Ireland, as we explore the wider Western canon and beyond on Writers from the Vault, a fortnightly feast of writing from the archive of works, famous and not so famous, old and not so old. So come along and lend me your ears every second Monday at 8:30 p.m., repeated the following Thursday at 3 p.m.
And now it's time for your sporting news. And before we read the death notices, we've just got time for the story on the back page with the headline, I love working with him. And here's Angela with the details.
And this is by Agran Latifi, a rugby league story. The good form of Christian Tuipulotu has been one of the positives for St. George Illawarra Dragons in recent weeks. The former Manly winger will play his third straight game for the Dragons on Sunday in the local derby against Cronulla at Shark Park. Dragons coach Shane Flanagan, who coached Tuipulotu during his time at the Sea Eagles, gave the Tongan international his first Red V start against the New Zealand Warriors. Tuipulotu more than held his own against one of the best wingers in the competition, in Dalen Watini Zelazniak, as the Dragons upstaged the Warriors in Wollongong. He was just as impressive on Anzac Day, despite the fact the Dragons were well beaten by the Roosters. His impressive form, combined with the return from injury of Michele Ravalawa and unavailability of Mosesi Suli, has also resulted in Zach Lomax getting another start in his preferred position of centre. The Parramatta-bound Lomax starred in his last outing and in the centres, contributing 14 points as St. George Illawarra beat the Warriors at Wynn Stadium. Speaking ahead of the Sharks game, Tuipulotu said his teammates had made him feel right at home and he was looking forward to doing his bit to contribute to more on-field success for the Dragons. He was also keen to repay the faith shown by Flanagan in recruiting the 23-year-old to the Dragons. "He was a big influence in my decision. I love working with him at Manly. He taught me a lot, and I'm still learning a lot from him. He was a big reason for me coming to the Dragons," Tuipulotu said. "It's been good. Starting the boys have welcomed me in, and obviously I knew Mosezi Suli from Manly, so that made the transition easy for me. It's been really good so far. I feel much better. I feel like I'm slowly progressing. It's up to me now to perform consistently, but I feel like I'm heading in the right direction under Flanagan." Barring their last start drubbing to the Roosters, the Dragons have also played some good football in the last month and head into the clash against the table-topping Sharks with a 4-4 win-loss record. Tuipulotu said, "While there were no easy games, it was good the Dragons had the chance to bounce back from the Roosters' loss with a local derby against the high-flying Sharks. We've reviewed the Roosters' loss and addressed what we need to fix, and now it is about moving forward and concentrating on trying to beat the Sharks," he said. "We have to shift our focus to the next game. We can't afford to worry too much about last week, because it will flow on to the next few weeks. We're stepping up for the new challenge of trying to beat the top of the table Sharks. We're ready for it. The boys are fired up after the loss last week, so we're ready for the challenge. We have focused on sticking to our plan. There were, obviously, a lot of things that didn't go our way last week. But during chaos, we need to hold back and trust our systems. We have to run hard and tackle hard. If we do those two things, hopefully, we can come away with the win. However, the Sharks, who have lost just one of seven games this season, have had the wood over the Dragons in recent years with victory in their last seven games against St George Illawarra. Last year, the Sharks were particularly ruthless against the Dragons, beating them twice, 52-18 and 40-8. And that was "I Love Working With Him," the article by Agron Latifi on the back page.
As the time is now 2 minutes past 11, we'll break into the sporting news to read today's death notices.
With the cooperation of the Illawarra Mercury, 2RPH presents a summary of death notices from today's edition.
And the death notices today appear on page 29. And there are just the four of them. The first, Chris Marchant. There's no details of where he's from or age. Clark, Desmond John Clark, at Montefiore Nursing Home, Randwick, aged 90. Kukulovsky, Zivko Kukulovsky, of Wollongong, aged 92 years. And finally today, Stefanovsky, Petra Stefanovsky, of Wollongong, aged 81 years. Turning to this next sporting story on page 34, Bennett keen to hear from South Sydney. And of course, this is a Rabbitohs story. Wayne Bennett has confirmed he's interested in a fairy tale return to the Rabbitohs as South Sydney go all in on pursuing the seven-time NRL Premiership winning coach. South's chief executive, Blake Solly, has indicated Bennett sits top of the list of potential successors to Jason Demetriou, who was sacked on Tuesday following 12 months of poor results. Chief Operating Officer Brock Schaefer was on Wednesday reported to have chosen to follow Demetriou out of the door after nearly a decade at the club. The Rabbitohs are hoping to appoint a new coach for 2025 in a matter of weeks and have pledged an exhaustive process to find an experienced campaigner. We'll take as long as it needs, but we'd probably prefer to have it done in weeks, not months, Solly said on Wednesday. The new head coach will be experienced. They don't necessarily have to be experienced coaching in NRL. But we're not going to go with a coach who hasn't coached first-team football before. Bennett was Demetrio's predecessor, guiding the Rabbitohs to a narrow grand final loss against Penrith in 2021, his last season in charge. The core of the club's current roster were on the books during Bennett's three seasons at the Souths, all of which stretched to at least the preliminary finals. The 74-year-old is due to step down at the Dolphins at the end of the season. AAP understands Bennett informed the Dolphins on Wednesday he was interested in speaking to the Rabbitohs. Long-time Souths assistant Ben Hornby, interim coach for Thursday's clash with Penrith and the rest of 2024, appears unlikely to be considered. Ex-Wallabies boss Michael Chika, South's recent premiership-winning coach Michael Maguire and Super League guru Steve McNamara have all been floaters as other options. But speaking on 2GB, Solly said Bennett was top of the list of prospective hires, though the club had yet to make a formal approach. Wayne had great success here, left the club on very good terms, Solly told reporters on Wednesday. We'll speak to Wayne, and if he's available and interested, certainly we'll progress that. He left the place in very good shape when he left. He got us through some really difficult times during COVID, a bit of a restructure of the playing group when John Sutton and Greg Inglis and Sam Burgess retired. He was a pleasure to work with. Solly said Bennett's proven ability to get the best out of fullback Latrell Mitchell and 5/8 Cody Walker made him worthy of strong consideration. The star pair are enduring miserable individual campaigns. Solly acknowledged the Rabbitohs had a unique playing group that required careful management. An assistant under Bennett and Demetrio, Burgess looks unlikely to make a return to Souths in 2025. The legendary Rabbitohs forward left the club last season amid reports of a falling out with Demetrio over perceived preferential treatment for Walker and Mitchell. He's now coaching English side Warrington, with his contract due to expire at the end of 2025. We wouldn't want to disrupt that, Solly said. My view is that is Sam's opportunity to show the world that he can coach. We wish him every success with that. And that story from page 34, Bennett keen to hear from South Sydney.
And on page 33, an article by Jordan Warren headed, Corrimal named Giraldi as new head coach. After recently parting ways with co-coaches Phil Matthias and Manny Mavridis, Illawarra Premier League side Corrimal has confirmed its new coach. Corrimal junior and former A-League product Des Giraldi will lead the Rangers for the remainder of the 2024 season, with his first game in the dugout set to be this Saturday, May the 4th, away to Wollongong United. Matthias and Mavridis, who signed at the beginning of the 2023 IPL season, were let go following a poor string of results which sees the team sit last on the ladder after 8 rounds. Corrimal has started 2024 with no wins from 7 games in the league and 27 goals conceded. The Rangers president, Mauri Vilela, said the club had appointed Giraldi to the head coaching role following the departure of Matthias and Mavridis. We're going in a different direction. The results weren't there, Vilela said. We've just parted ways. The club's going in a different direction and we've appointed a new coach, Des Giraldi. Giraldi began his playing journey in football with Corrimal Juniors before having stints at the Wollongong Wolves and the old Australian Institute of Sport, AIS. The former Australia Under-20 international has played professionally in Italy for Empoli and Australia for Adelaide and Sydney FC. He also played for Dandaloo and Tarawana in the IPL. Giraldi will begin his stint as coach against United at Macedonia Park this Saturday. This fixture was one of the Rangers' best results in 2023 when they won 4-3. And that was Coromel named Giraldi as new head coach, written by Jordan Warren and appearing on page 33.
Jordan Warren writes this next story also on page 33. Four Illawarra sides are chasing cup glory. And of course, this is women's football. Illawarra football sides will be dreaming of a deep run in the Sapphire Cup following release of the latest draw. Football New South Wales officials conducted the draw on Wednesday, the 1st of May, with four local sides still in the running in the knockout competition. The competition mirrors the Men's Waratah Cup knockout competition. In the 2023 edition of the tournament, IWPL League champions Winoona and NPL women's side, the South Coast Flame, reached the furthest. In round three, Illawarra Women's Premier League Grand Final champions Shell Harbour were drawn a home fixture against the winner of Connells Point versus Camden Tigers. The Flame were also drawn a home game against Leeville Colts. Meanwhile, there is a potential all-Illawarra affair in the making, with the winner of Bankstown and Bulleye going on to host Albion Park White. Eagles... that's part of that name. It's on a separate line here. So the match between Bankstown and Bulleye is going on to host Albion Park White Eagles. Venues and fixture times are yet to be confirmed. The Sapphire Cup derives its name from the former New South Wales Sapphires team, who were part of the former Women's National Soccer League. The competition was created just prior to the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup, which was held in Australia and New Zealand. Football New South Wales State League powerhouses Apia won that tournament last year. And that was a story from page 33, Four Illawarra Sides Chasing Cup Glory. And the article was written by Jordan Warren.
And on page 32, Lockie Blazing Path for South Coast Male Netballers. And this is by Joshua Bartlett. When Lockie Arbuckle became interested in netball, he never could have dreamed that it would lead to him potentially playing the sport for Australia. In fact, he was more concerned about finding other men to pass the ball with. While men's netball isn't the most publicised code, it has enjoyed a spike in popularity in Australia in recent years. And Arbuckle is one person who benefited from the post-COVID rise. The teenager tried the sport for the first time in primary school, but has become a regular on the netball court over the few years. Arbuckle, who is a training partner at New South Wales Premier League club South Coast Blaze, has shown plenty of natural talent in the wing defence position. He recently represented the New South Wales under-17s team at the Australian Men's and Mixed National Championship, with the side claiming bronze. The 15-year-old's good form at the tournament has seen him called up to an Australian men's under-17 selection camp on the New South Wales Northern Beaches this weekend. Run by the Australian Men's and Mixed Netball Association, the camp is a key selection trial for the Aussie team to compete in their international program later this year. "I'm over the moon to be picked. It's pretty cool," Arbuckle told the Mercury. "The National Championships was a really good learning experience because it was the third time that I've gone to that. I went in with a different mindset this time. The last two times, it was all still relatively new. But this time I knew what I was in for and I wanted to focus on what I've been working on." From this camp, the top 12 will be selected to go and represent Australia against Samoa and New Zealand. 2024 also marks Arbuckle's second year with the South Coast Blaze. He joined the New South Wales Premier League club in early 2023 as a coach by leading their junior team at the Blaze Cup Carnival. However, his playing abilities became apparent pretty quickly, and the Ambervale native participated in several skills clinics before being selected into the Blazers' talent identification program. The teen became a Blaze training partner in the latter stages of the last season on his way to being named the 2023 TIP Athlete of the Year. Arbuckle was their first training partner selected for 2024, and he continues to attend sessions with the club's under-23s and open sides. In between these duties, he has continued to run skills clinics for the Campbelltown District Netball Association and drives to Sydney each Wednesday night to support Blaze players from the sidelines. Since Arbuckle has become a Blaze member, the club has introduced two more male training partners, Stephen Bryce and Danian Makem. There's been major growth post-COVID in men's netball. The amount of people now playing is crazy, Arbuckle, who hails from an Aussie rules background, said. When I started, I found it difficult to even find a team for men, so it's been good to see. And that was Lockie, Blazing Path for South Coast Male Netballers, written by Joshua Bartlett and appearing on page 32.
Hi folks, Dano Rogerson here. You know, reading newspapers, books and magazines is not an easy game. Radio 2RPH, make it sound easy.
And the time is a quarter past 11. Coming up next, today's editorial.
Tune in to 2RPH every day to hear the headlines, news stories and feature articles from the nation's leading newspapers. Monday to Saturday, you can hear the major stories making the pages of the Sydney Morning Herald, the Daily Telegraph and the Australian, read to you live by our team of talented volunteers. And on Sundays, what would Sunday be without the Sunday papers? Listeners in Newcastle and the Lower Hunter can hear readings from the Newcastle Herald from 10 o'clock Monday to Friday and 2 p.m. on Saturday. If you're in Wollongong and the Illawarra, you'll hear the Illawarra Mercury at the same time. So tune in every weekday morning from 7 o'clock, on Saturday from 8 o'clock and on Sunday from 10 o'clock. 2RPH, your radio reading service.
And at 17 minutes past 11, it's time for today's editorial, which is today on page 23. And its headline is Bonza's Woes, a Blow to Region's Roots. Nobody likes to hear about a cancelled flight. Whether it's leaving us stranded or delaying a visit from others, the unexpected but perennial feature of air travel is almost always delivering ruin to the best laid plans. The halt on Tuesday of airline Bonza's flights, amid an assessment of the company's ongoing viability, was hard to read as anything but ominous for its fortunes. The airline's website stopped taking bookings, then entered voluntary administration. We apologise to our customers who are impacted by this, and we're working as quickly as possible to determine a way forward that ensures there is ongoing competition in the Australian domestic aviation market, Bonza CEO Tim Jordan said. Bonza's services were a boon for passengers across New South Wales, keen to explore a greater variety of both departure and arrival schedules. And once again, we've gone to reading mode. Might be a second. It isn't the first time Bonza was trimmed its offerings. The company scrapped 5 routes in July of last year, dropping its trips between the region and the Sunshine Coast from 4 to 3 each week. Domestic air travel in Australia is an unforgiving business. Names like Ansett, Tiger Air and Impulse have not faded into history by sheer bad luck alone. Bonza's Road is its own, of course, and is one that has yet to run its full course. Government intervention with rival carriers to relocate potentially stranded passengers, though, is unlikely to buoy immediate confidence. Arriving in January of 2023, the airline's likely hopes of capitalising on travel-deprived populace after COVID-19 restrictions began to fade, instead copped the hammer blow of a cost of living crisis. Hopefully, Bonza can succeed where many others have failed and revive its fortunes through restructure or other corporate alchemy. With huge players, Qantas and Virgin, as rivals, though, even a revival will offer little solace to those who were already concerned about the viability of the new player. That was today's editorial. Bonza's woes were a blow to the region's roots. We'll be back with a feature piece shortly. Now, normally we have two opinion pieces at this time. There are no opinion pieces today. However, we have an interesting article, Community Toasts the Rise of Women's and Girls' Football. Angela has the details, and here's that story.
Yes, and this is written by Joshua Bartlett and appears on page 33. Women's football continues to thrive in the Illawarra, and the local community is ready to stop and celebrate these exciting achievements. Football South Coast will host an array of events to celebrate Female Football Week, an Australian-wide initiative that will run from Friday, May the 3rd to Sunday, May the 12th. Female Football Week celebrates the growth of women's football at all levels of the round ball game across the nation and acknowledges the important role that women play in the sport. FSC will run various free come and try events during the Female Football Week, including a Mums and Minis program and a Girls Love Football program. We are particularly excited to celebrate all of the local clubs and the females who are involved in every aspect of the game, FSC female football manager Sonia Keir told the Mercury. We're seeing women running clubs and volunteering and getting involved just to make sure that the girls can get a team together and get on the field. It's really inspiring. The impact of the 2023... Oops, I've lost my spot. I'm sorry. No, I've... Gone.
Reading newspapers, books, and magazines every day. This is your radio reading service, 2RPH.
You're listening to a feature article from today's Illawarra Mercury. Now, a couple of times we've had presenter dropouts. We're using tablets now to read the news rather than cutting up newspapers. And sometimes they have a reader view and they have an image of the newspaper. And sometimes they just jump between the two, which means that you temporarily lose your place. We're now ready to continue with that article.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I've now found my spot. The impact of the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup being held in Australia continues to be felt in the Illawarra, which has seen a significant growth in female involvement in Football South Coast programs. FSC's women's player registrations are up by 28% across all ages in the past 12 months. In the youth grades, Minirroo's girls' teams, ages 5 to 11 years, have increased by 50%, while there has also been significant growth for girls' youth teams, up 43%. Female referee registrations are up by 23%, while there are 24% more women's volunteers, including coaches and club officials, involved in the game compared to last year. Other highlights in the past 12 months include FSC launching an inaugural over-40s women's competition and running a mini World Cup for under-12s and under-13s girls. We are so excited. The growth in females from ages 5 to 65 in football is unbelievable, Kia said. It's not just in the playing space. We're seeing growth in terms of volunteers, coaches and managers as well. It's really inspiring to see that enthusiasm and everybody registering to be part of the game. We can see everybody still talking about the Matildas and their amazing achievements, and everyone is also really pumped for the upcoming Olympics. And that was Community Toasts the Rise of Women's and Girls Football, and it was written by Joshua Bartlett.
And now, with the time being 25 minutes past 11, it's time for Your Say and Letters to the Editor.
2RPH presents Your Say, a selection of us from today's Illawarra Mercury.
And the letters today are on page 23. And regular correspondent Tom Wren from Mangaton writes under the heading Tracking for Domestic Violence Offenders. Put simply, I'm so saddened by the impact of domestic violence by men towards women. One type of immediate action may be to put an ankle bracelet tracking a male who has domestic violence towards women. If he's in the wrong area, he's removed and locked up for a minimum of 7 days, ideally in a women's prison, for starters. Sanctuaries for women and children with female security guards. One suggestion might be the empty buildings owned by religious orders. There's one down the end of Crown Street, funded by parishioners and governments for years, and now being underutilised. And so wrote Tom Wren of Mangaton.
And Dom Filiomani of Port Kembla writes under the heading Australians Need to Be Put First. The recent attack on a woman by a released illegal refugee has caused me significant distress, and I'm sure many Australians. Since the High Court majority decision finding that it was illegal for the Australian government to indefinitely detain illegal refugees, a number of the released individuals have gone on to commit crimes, mostly against women. I find it incredible that the High Court put greater value and onus on the rights of the illegal refugee than the rights and safety of the Australian people. These illegal refugees were in detention for a reason. That is, they were criminals in their home country, a country that did not want them back, and were now Australia's problem. It is time that the High Court ceases its ideological bent, applies the law as passed by the Australian Parliament, and has the safety and rights of the Australians first and foremost. And that was Dom Filiomani from Port Kembla.
And writer Jeff Mooney of Lake Illawarra writes under the heading System Feeding Inequality. 3 weeks ago, I wrote the following email to the federal member, and in particular, our local member, Stephen Jones. It seems to be a global problem, though there are smarter countries that have fought the rise of inequality. Our Australia can and must do the same. Our current economic system and policy settings are feeding inequality on a daily basis. The growing division between the rich and poor supports that. Socially, this is not sustainable, and morally, it's corrupt. Tinkering around the edges is making no difference at all. We need change, something that politicians fear for the fear it generates. So, to make substantial change, we first need commitment, then education, and then action. Please take this matter extremely seriously. I should have known better than to expect a response, but I'm disappointed anyway. Seems it's just a subject that is best ignored while they get on with more trivial matters. And that final letter for today, System Feeding Inequality, was by Jeff Mooney of Lake Illawarra.
Your Say can be heard tomorrow at the same time on 2RPH.
And that brings to a close our presentation of the Illawarra Mercury for today. And our thanks to the publishers for their cooperation. 2RPH brings you readings from the Mercury at 10 o'clock each morning, Monday to Friday, and at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoons. We're crossing now to the main studio for live readings of The Australian with the team Rosemary Atkinson, Gail Bifus and Judy Hughes. And between 4 and 5:30 this afternoon is Features Forum, bringing you background, opinion, commentary and more from all of our daily newspapers. My name is Keith McCarran, and with me today has been Angela Rontidis. Thank you, Angela.
You're most welcome, Keith.
And thank you for joining us. Angela and I will be back tomorrow with more Illawarra Mercury. Until then, thanks for listening.
This recording of the Illawarra Mercury will remain on the site for a period of 24 hours only, which will expire at 11:30 for Friday. 2RPH sincerely thanks the publisher for cooperation in allowing us to provide this audio file. You are reminded that the material is copyright and is available for personal listening only.